Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
The Dawn of Man. Remember that? Well, the scene from the movie 2001 A Space Odyssey. Picture it. Put yourself there. We see all these lucky little monkey people get to finally eat some meat. A food that in the 3 million years of evolution that followed that scene in that movie would become a staple of the human diet. Roughly 10,000 years ago, the human diet changed considerably. With the agricultural revolution, people started to eat grains. Now, those who are advocates of the paleo diet would say that these 10,000 years are a mere flash in the pan. And they argue that we, human beings, have not had enough time to catch up evolutionarily to that dietary change. They would argue we are still built to eat and benefit from a pre-agricultural revolution diet. So just for a thought experiment, let's put some numbers to that. Human beings started what we would call a paleo diet maybe 2.5 or 3 million years ago. 10,000 years ago, our diets came to include grain. So if you scaled that to one person's life, a 40-year-old person, that 10,000 years would be equivalent to less than half of 1% of his or her entire life. Now let's move beyond delicious meats and berries and nuts and veggies. And let's talk about the evolution of the human brain. We talked extensively already in this series about the brain, its various parts, and how those parts participate in the memory process. On the show today, we're going to talk about learning styles, learning spectrums, and memory encoding strategies. But I don't think, no matter what, at least from the research I've done, we could train all the parts of our brain that participate in the memory process to work equally well. So just like the human gut, the human brain, and the memories that it helps to create, evolved through a process of natural selection in a world that was dramatically different from the one we live in today. And think about how much that world has changed in just the last 20 years. Just like our bodies, if you buy into what the proponents of the paleo diet are selling, are not properly evolved to eat a high-grain diet, our brains are pretty damn far away from the ideal memory-making equipment of the information age in the 21st century. When we revisit our friends from the dawn of man, or even up to more modern humans like hunter-gatherers, we see beings that lived with an entirely different set of memory tasks. There were no tests to study for. There were no instructions to follow. There were no phone numbers to know. There were no names to remember of people who you met at a party. Hunter-gatherers lived in small and pretty regular groups. But what they did need to remember, and their survival depended on it, was where to find food, where to find resources, which plants are edible, which plants are poisonous, and how do I get home? Those are the memory skills that ensured the survival of the human species. And those memory skills are almost entirely visual, spatial, and navigational. And that's important. Good day, everybody. Today is June 1st, 2016, and we're winding down in our look at the human memory, some strategies for improving that memory, and some behavioral lifestyle choices that might help improve brain function if practiced. Anyway, let's get on with today's show. The last two discussions in this series will focus on memory improvement strategies. Today's discussion will deal with registration, learning, encoding, the next show, retention, and recall. And encoding is simply the transportation of the contents of the working memory into the long-term memory. Now, in school, we had to remember things for tests and grades. And as I said in an earlier show, we didn't learn too much about the inner workings of our minds or techniques to become better and, God forbid, more self-sufficient learners. The only memory technique that I can remember learning in school, and if you're younger, maybe it's changed. Maybe there's been some kind of revolution. Maybe the show is obsolete. Maybe I should read the papers. But from the conversations that I've had with students in recent years, I think it's a safe bet that things are still pretty much done the same way. Rote rehearsal. Repetition. Now, you might remember this in the very early grades, saying things aloud over and over again. You know, learning things like multiplication tables, vocabulary words. But those lessons are in really, really foundational years of our educational development. And it would be a great time to learn about how to be better operators of our minds. So rote rehearsal is the least effective memory technique available. Repetition. Why? It really requires no mental exertion to just repeat things. Now, school does, by the time you get to high school, I think you explore other basic memory strategies, things like chunking when you're trying to learn many items, they're sorted into groups. Rhyming, you know all these rhymes, 30 days has December, May, July, and October. All the rest have 28 except for February, which is really great. So it's not like school teaches us nothing. But learning through rhyme, again, there's a lack of mental effort there. And then there's more advanced mnemonics school doesn't really touch on, like self-referencing, building a relationship between yourself and the information you're learning, learning with the preparation to teach the material. That's very scarce. School misses a ton of opportunities with self-referencing. And another neglected mnemonic in school is spacing. This is the act of spreading out the learning of new information versus cramming for it right before a test, which is very popular in high school and college. So we could start with general questions like, do you value simplicity or do you enjoy intricate stories and explanations? We've touched on this before, the seven styles of learning, and I'll run through them quickly, but that's another thing I would recommend putting some thought into. What best describes, you know, your practices and your strengths? Now, one wrench that I would throw in the learning styles theory, which was developed relatively recently in the 1980s by a psychologist at Harvard University named Howard Gardner. Originally, this certainly had an appeal to me, I think as early as graduate school when there was a lot of talk about this, because it calls for a more student-centered approach to learning and kind of condemns the whole molding process of school. Unfortunately, there is really no scientific evidence any of us would acquire or retain information more effectively if it's presented through the medium that we like best or that we feel most comfortable with. In fact, I think a lot of us have had really powerful experiences when we're forced to work outside of our intellectual comfort zones, not just looking for information or means of obtaining information that are tuned to your frequency, but challenging yourself. I think a lot of you already know this. So while Gardner's theories did certainly take off in non-actionable discussions in places like teacher training and education grad school programs, it hasn't really translated to the school in any meaningful way. School is still primarily top-down, where there's an expectation that the learner will fit a mold designed by the teacher. School uses two of these learning styles, or two, are very, very heavily favored, which obviously means a lot of learners fall behind. So school is primarily verbal and sequential learning. But I think that actually brings up some refinement that this whole learning styles discussion needs. And I want to give you another way to evaluate practices in your learning strategies beyond the seven styles. But if the seven styles are completely new to you, I would just like to quickly define them. They're all, you know, pretty much self-explanatory just from their name alone. Visual, spatial learners would be one. Pictures, images, spatial understanding, infographics, video. The second one, aural, A-U-R-A-L, auditory or musical.
people who best acquire information through verbal lectures, discussions, and presentations. 3, verbal, which is linguistic, people who learn best through words, regardless of whether they're communicated in speech or writing. Detailed written explanations over physical or visual demonstrations. 4, physical or kinesthetic, people who prefer using their body, or their hands, or their sense of touch to explore the world. If you've ever worked in an educational setting, you can identify people who have a strong preference for physical learning because they have trouble sitting still for long periods of time, like every boy you've probably ever encountered between the ages of 3 and 18. Logical, mathematical, or sequential is the 5th type after physical. People who have a keen sense for numbers, sequence, association, and problem solving. 6, social or interpersonal, people who really benefit from group learning, people who really seek out and enjoy interactive settings. And then 7 is solitary or intrapersonal, those who benefit most from non-social self-study. This whole 7 learning styles theory has, in my opinion, one of the same problems school forces on young people, and that's you get stuck in a box. Nobody is one of these learning styles. You might have heard that list of 7 and said to yourself, well, I certainly do have a strong preference, or I find myself gravitating towards, you know, visual or verbal, etc. But a more advanced way of thinking about this was developed in the 1990s, and it is called Felder and Silverman's Learning Styles Index. They rethought the 7 learning styles as 4 dimensions. And every single one of us can, you know, plot ourselves somewhere on one of these 4 spectrums. And they are sensory to intuitive. This is the first one. So sensory learners prefer concrete, practical, procedural information. The other side of that spectrum is intuitive. Learners who prefer conceptual, innovative, and theoretical information. So people who are excited by theoretical discussions, really as a means of motivation. So that's the first spectrum, sensory to intuitive. The second spectrum is visual to verbal. So on the visual side, people who prefer graphs, pictures, diagrams, just like the visual style of learning, to verbal, people who prefer to hear or read information. The third spectrum, active to reflective. So active are the physical learners, people who prefer to manipulate objects and learn by trying. Reflective, the other end of that spectrum, are people who prefer to think through, to evaluate options, and learn by analysis. So that spectrum right there covers 4 of the learning styles. The active are the physical, but the active are also the social, while the reflective are the more solitary or intrapersonal, but also the logical, mathematical. And the last learning spectrum is sequential to global. So sequential learners are people who prefer to have information presented linearly and orderly. Inductive thinkers, people who put together the details in order to understand how the big picture emerges. The other side of that spectrum is global, people who prefer a holistic and systematic approach, people who see the big picture first and then fill in the details, so more of a deductive approach. Now, you can plot yourself on each one of those 4 spectrums, and I think that gives you a much better sense of where you stand in your learning preferences and strategies versus just the 7 styles alone. So something to think about as I go through the list of memory strategies for better registration. And one last caveat, I want to make a distinction between this discussion of registration strategies versus learning strategies generally. So we've done a series in the past that I really hope you would have heard by now on the Trivium. The Trivium is a learning system. What we're doing today, this is not a self-contained learning system. This is a set of enhancements or extra considerations for mindful intake of new information. You know, what I was looking for when I set out to do these shows was like a quick, action-oriented approach to memory improvement, built on increased knowledge that led to some basic changes in habits and a more mindful approach. Mindful is a word that's going to come up a lot today. To encoding, storing, and retrieving new information. But I feel like we have to start in a place
It's almost a place I wanted to avoid in this series. So there's this term. And like I said, I wanted to avoid this. I thought it's neat and there's something here, but it's impractical and it really doesn't fit into this series. But I think it's information that needs to be kept in mind. The term is memory palace, right? Well, there's a story that dates back to the 5th century BCE, passed to us by an anonymous book written in the 1st century BCE called Rhetorica Ad Herennium. It relates to something called the method of loci, defined in the John O'Keefe and Lynn Nadel book, The Hippocampus as a Cognitive Map. The method of loci is an imaginal technique known to the ancient Greeks and Romans. In this technique, the subject memorizes the layout of some building or the arrangement of shops on a street or any geographical entity which is composed of a number of discrete loci. When desiring to remember a set of items, the subject walks through these loci in their imagination and commits an item to each one by forming an image between the item and any feature of that locus. Retrieval of items is achieved by walking through the loci, allowing the latter to activate the desired items. So loci, plural for the Latin word locus, meaning place, dates back to, as I said earlier, the 5th century BC.
One of the more elaborate techniques dates back 2,500 years to ancient Greece, came to be known as the memory palace. The story behind its creation goes like this. There was a poet called Simonides who was attending a banquet. He was actually the hired entertainment because back then, if you wanted to throw a really slamming party, you didn't hire a DJ, you hired a poet. And he stands up, delivers his poem from memory, walks out the door, and at the moment he does, the banquet hall collapses. Kills everybody inside. Doesn't just kill everybody, it mangles the bodies beyond all recognition. Nobody can say who was inside. Nobody can say where they were sitting. The bodies can't be properly buried. It's one tragedy compounding another. Simonides, standing outside, the sole survivor amid the wreckage, closes his eyes and has this realization, which is that in his mind's eye, he can see where each of the guests at the banquet had been sitting. And he takes the relatives by the hand and guides them each to their loved ones amid the wreckage. What Simonides figured out at that moment is something that I think we all kind of intuitively know, which is that as bad as we are at remembering names and phone numbers and word-for-word instructions from our colleagues, we have really exceptional visual and spatial memories. The idea behind the memory palace is to create this imagined edifice in your mind's eye and populate it with images of the things that you want to remember. The crazier, weirder, more bizarre, funnier, raunchier, stinkier the image is, the more unforgettable it's likely to be. This is advice that goes back 2,000 plus years to the earliest Latin memory treatises.
But the knowledge of this technique, which still sounds completely unbelievable, and I'm going to flesh it out better, is passed to us through only two works that I know of, the Rhetorica Ad Herennium that I mentioned, and another book on rhetoric written by Cicero. And one of the speculations why there isn't a bunch of writing about the technique of loci or the memory palace is that in a different world, ancient Greece going forward until it was lost at some point in the Middle Ages, this was common knowledge. And I wanted to share just a quick excerpt for more explanation of this from lightmind.com. Develop perfect memory with the memory palace technique. The memory palace technique is based on the fact that we're extremely good at remembering places we know. As I said in the opening of the show, we've evolved to do this. A memory palace is a metaphor for any well-known place that you're able to easily visualize. It can be the inside of your home or maybe the route you take every day to work. That familiar place will be your guide to store and recall any kind of information. Let's see how it works. There's 5 steps to using the memory palace technique. Step 1, choose your palace. First and foremost, you need to pick a place you're very familiar with. The effectiveness of this technique relies on your ability to mentally see and walk around that place with ease. You should be able to be there at will using your mind's eye only. A good first choice could be your own home, for example. Remember that the more vividly you can visualize that place's details, the more effective your memorization will be. Also, try to define a specific route in your palace instead of just visualizing a static scene. So instead of simply picturing your home, imagine a specific walkthrough in your home. This makes the technique much more powerful as you'll be able to recall items in a specific order, as we'll see in the next step. Here are some additional suggestions that work well as memory palaces along with the possible routes. Familiar streets in your city, a current or former school, a place of work, or familiar scenery. 2. List distinctive features. Now you need to pay attention to specific features in the place you chose. If you picked a walkthrough in your home, for example, the first notable feature would probably be the front door. Now go on and mentally walk around your memory palace. After you go through the door, what's in the first room? Analyze the room methodically. You may define a standard procedure, such as always looking from left to right, for example. What's the next feature that catches your attention? It may be the central table in the dining room or a picture on the wall. Continue taking mental notes of those features as you go. Each one of them will be a memory slot that you'll use later to store a single piece of information. 3. Imprint the palace on your mind. For the technique to work, the most important thing is to have the place or route 100% imprinted on your mind. Do whatever is necessary to really commit it to memory. If you're a visual kind of person, you probably won't have trouble with this. Otherwise, here are some tips that help. Physically walk through the route, repeating out loud the distinctive features as you see them. Write down the selected features on a piece of paper and mentally walk through them, repeating them out loud. Always look at the features from the same point of view. Be aware that visualization is just a skill. If you're still having trouble doing this, you may want to develop your visualization skills first. And we are going to talk about that more in this show. And finally, when you believe you're done, go over it one more time. It's really important to overlearn your way in the memory palace. Once you're confident that the route is stamped on your mind, you're set. Now you have your palace, which can be used over and over again to memorize just about anything you want. 4, associate. Now that you're the master of your palace, it's time to put it to good use. Like most memory enhancement systems, the Memory Palace Techniques works with the use of visual associations. The process is simple. You take a known image called the memory peg and combine it with the element you want to memorize. For us, each memory peg is a distinctive feature of our memory palace. So the author mentions an article that he wrote called Improve Your Memory by Speaking Your Mind's Language. And then he says, as I described in that article, there's a right way of doing visual associations. Make it crazy, ridiculous, offensive, unusual, extraordinary, animated, nonsensical. After all, these are the things that get remembered, aren't they? Make the scene so unique that it could never happen in real life. The only rule is, if it's boring, it's wrong. Although we can use this technique to memorize tons of information, let's start with something very simple, using our home memory palace to memorize a groceries list. Let's suppose the first item on that list is bacon, obviously. Of course it is. Mentally transport yourself into the memory palace. The first feature you see in your mind is your home's front door. Now, in a ludicrous way, visually combine bacon with the sight of your front door, like giant fried bacon strips flowing out from underneath the door, reaching for your legs, just like zombies. Feel the touch of the bacon hands on your legs. Feel the smell of the evil bacon. Is that remarkable enough? Folks, bear with me here. Bear with me. Now open the door and keep walking, following the exact same route you defined before. Look at the next distinctive feature and associate it with the second item to be memorized. Suppose the next item is eggs, and the second feature is picture of mother-in-law. Well, at this point, you already know what to do. The process is always the same, so just keep mentally associating images until there are no items left to memorize. 5. Visit your palace. At this point, you're done memorizing the items. If you're new to the technique, though, you'll probably need to do a little rehearsal, repeating the journey at least once in your mind. If you start from the same point and follow the same route, the memorized items will come to your mind instantly as you look at the journey's selected features. Go from the beginning to the end of your route, paying attention to those features and replaying the scenes in your mind. When you get to the end of the route,
turn around, and walk in the opposite direction until you get to the starting point. In the end, it's all a matter of developing your visualization skills. The more relaxed you are, the easier it will be, and the more effective your memorization will be. Now, some of you are saying, Brett, cut the shit with this. Give me a break.
Well, patience, please. Another story. I started to really get motivated to do a series about memory, actually in March, or I guess it was late February, when I was doing preparation for the shows on creativity. And I kept running into this relationship between memory and imagination. And I tucked away some articles because I was intrigued by this connection. And one of the interesting people that I ultimately encountered was a journalist named Joshua Foer, F-O-E-R, who had immersed himself in the world of memory competitions. And he befriended and was ultimately taken under the wing of a memory competitor named Ed Cook, who trained him. And within a year, Joshua Foer went on to win a memory championship that he entered really just for a story. And here's a clip of Joshua Foer. That was actually him you heard earlier in the show. This is from his TED Talk. And he is explaining here what I think is going to be one of the essential takeaways in today's show.
And while there are a whole host of ways of remembering stuff in these competitions, everything, all of the techniques that are being used, ultimately come down to a concept that psychologists refer to as elaborative encoding. And it's well illustrated by a nifty paradox known as the Baker-Baker paradox, which goes like this. If I tell two people to remember the same word, if I say to you, remember that there is a guy named Baker, that's his name, and I say to you, remember that there is a guy who is a baker, okay? And I come back to you at some point later on, and I say, do you remember that word that I had told you a while back? Do you remember what it was? The person who is told his name is a baker is less likely to remember the same word than the person who is told his job is that he is a baker. Same word, different amount of remembering. That's weird. What's going on here? Well, the name Baker doesn't actually mean anything to you. It is entirely untethered from all of the other memories floating around in your skull, but the common noun Baker, we know bakers. Bakers wear funny white hats. Bakers have flour on their hands. Bakers smell good when they come home from work. Maybe we even know a baker. And when we first hear that word, we start putting these associational hooks into it that make it easier to fish it back out at some later date. The entire art of what is going on in these memory contests and the entire art of remembering stuff better in everyday life is figuring out ways to transform capital B bakers into lowercase b bakers, to take information that is lacking in context, in significance, in meaning, and transform it in some way so that it becomes meaningful in the light of all of the other things that you have in your mind.
So in one of his articles, this one appearing in the New York Times, he wrote, in 2003, the Journal of Nature reported on 8 people who finished near the top of the World Memory Championships. The study looked at whether the memorizers' brains were structurally different from the rest of ours, or whether they were just making better use of the memorizing abilities we all possess. Researchers put the mental athletes and a group of control subjects into fMRI scanners and asked them to memorize 3-digit numbers, black and white photographs of people's faces, and magnified images of snowflakes as their brains were being scanned. What they found was surprising. Not only did the brains of the mental athletes appear anatomically indistinguishable from those of the control subjects, but on every test of general cognitive ability, the mental athlete's scores came back well within the normal range. When Cook told me he was an average guy with an average memory, it wasn't just modestly speaking. There was, however, one telling difference between the brains of the mental athletes and those of the control subjects. When the researchers looked at the parts of the brain that were engaged when the subjects memorized, they found that the mental athletes were relying more heavily on regions known to be involved in spatial memory, which, as you learned in an earlier show, no doubt, is the hippocampus and the frontal cortex. At first glance, this didn't seem to make sense.
Why would mental athletes be navigating spaces in their minds while trying to learn three-digit numbers? The answer lies in a discovery supposedly made by a poet named Simonides in the 5th century BC after a tragic banquet hall collapse of which he was the sole survivor. Simonides was asked to give an account of who was buried in the debris. When the poet closed his eyes and reconstructed the crumbled building in his imagination, he had an extraordinary realization. He remembered where each of the guests at the ill-fated dinner had been sitting. Even though he made no conscious effort to memorize the layout of the room, it nonetheless left a durable impression. From that simple observation, Simonides reportedly invented a technique that would form the basis of what came to be known as the art of memory. He realized that if there hadn't been guests sitting at a banquet table, but, say, every Greek dramatist seated in order of birth, or each of the words in one of his poems, or every item he needed to accomplish that day, he would have remembered that instead. He reasoned that just about anything could be imprinted on our memories and kept in good order simply by constructing a building in the imagination and filling it with imagery of what needed to be recalled. This imagined edifice could then be walked through at any time in the future. Such a building would later come to be called the Memory Palace. Now, many of you, maybe a lot of you who were telling me to cut the shit a few minutes back, are saying this seems completely impractical. Because sure, I mean, maybe this is an interesting mental exercise, but it's really something that seems suited primarily to, one, a pre-technological world, you know, like when you didn't have other capture devices to help you remember elaborate to-do lists, or two, memory competitions. So why would you take the time and the effort to build and master a technique like the Memory Palace? Well, the truth is, I don't think you have to, but I do think that the principles behind these methods are absolutely essential things to keep in mind as we progress through the rest of this discussion. Remember, in the beginning of this series, I said that one of the most important aspects or prerequisites for making new memories is the paying of attention. One of the big reasons why a visual imagery technique like the Memory Palace or other forms of loci are so effective is that they force the learner or the memorizer to turn up mindfulness at the moment of encountering new information. The key to better encoding begins with presence, attention to detail, elaborative, or at the very least, mindful intake, and making new information visual whenever possible, however possible. So we're going to break our encoding discussion into three parts with those goals in mind.
Here's a question. Do you sometimes have difficulty remembering people's names, but you're great at remembering their faces? Or maybe you're really good at moving odd-shaped furniture around corners, or packing your car full with so much stuff everyone told you it was going to be impossible. If so, you might just be a visual thinker. How about this? Try and remember an event from your past. What happens? Do you find yourself remembering something fuzzy, like the significance or emotion or mood around that event? Or do you remember specific scenes and images? For some people, it turns out that images and spatial relationships seem to dominate their thinking process. Basically, they think in pictures. It's thought that upwards of 60% of people are in this category, and it's a continuum, not all or none. Some people just think this way more than others. For example, for some people, and this might be you, a messy desk isn't a problem at all. You know where everything is, but you know where it is in relation to everything else. So when someone comes along and cleans that desk up, supposedly helping you organize, you completely feel lost and you can't find anything. The same sort of spatial thinking that helps you navigate a messy desk can be incredibly powerful. The chess grandmaster Bobby Fischer said that he could see all of the pieces on the chessboard even when it wasn't in front of him, which allowed him to practice and play in his head. Nikola Tesla, a pretty amazing inventor, took this one step further and said he was able to build and rebuild complicated machines in his mind and then run them to see where the moving parts could potentially fail. When he was only 24 years old, the inventor Thomas Edison described his experience this way: "I have innumerable machines in my mind now, which I shall continue to illustrate and describe day by day when I have the spare time." But this kind of thinking, visual thinking, sometimes comes with a price. Namely, it can be hard to communicate what you're thinking to other people. Maybe you've had this experience where you see something pretty clearly in your head, but you wind up needing to draw it to explain it to someone else. Albert Einstein often said words failed him to describe the images in his head, but it turned out that those images were the key to unlocking the secrets of the universe. It was after he envisioned a man riding a wave of light that he was able to construct his theory of relativity. James Clerk Maxwell, the mathematical physicist, had a similar experience. His colleagues urged him to show the relationship between energy, entropy, and volume using equations, which is how they best communicated ideas. Instead, he used clay and plaster to show the relationship in the way that he understood it, as a physical and visual form of thermodynamics. And that's the power of visual metaphors. They allow people to see complex relationships in new, relatively simple ways. And the history of invention and discovery is filled with those kind of stories. For example, Auguste Kekulé unlocked a new way of thinking about the structure of molecules when he envisioned a snake eating its own tail. In that moment, he realized that the bonds in the molecule benzene formed a ring. And this led to a whole new way of understanding how molecules could be visualized. And that's ultimately the challenge that visual thinkers face. How do you get those images out of your head and into the real world, as inventions or discoveries? It's also why right now is such an exciting time for people who think like this. The digital age has brought technology that allows visual thinkers to directly experiment with the forms that they're best at understanding. Visual thinkers can now fold complex proteins on the screen or use 3D printers to build almost any form they can imagine. And they can invent and play in virtual reality spaces that just couldn't exist in the real world. It's a good time to be a visual thinker.
The techniques that we're going to discuss intensify our attention, in turn influencing what we're able to absorb into our long-term memories. So at the registration phase, the encountering of new information, stronger memories occur in three different ways. Number one, we're able to produce stronger memory traces. Second, we're going to talk about attributes, ways of making the information that we're trying to remember richer in our minds. And the third is associations, the establishment of connections between two or more items you're trying to learn. This would also include the discovery of patterns. So let's use the example of meeting somebody new for the first time. Every time I meet a new person in a fairly chaotic setting, I usually forget his or her name just moments later. So I want to strengthen the trace of the memory of that person's name. I might try to tie it through the paying of attention to attributes about that person. So I'm not just trying to remember a name, but if when that name was said to me, I took that piece of information aside and started to inventory attributes about it. Think about it like almost in astronomical terms. Something that becomes bigger has a stronger gravity. So if somebody says, hey, Brett, this is Bob, I just say, guy named Bob. But if I look at Bob and I say, oh, Bob is a little taller than me, he's a little older than me, he has this kind of facial expression, I built a larger collection of data about Bob. And when I go to retrieve Bob, it is now tied to these other details. That whole body that is Bob has a stronger gravity in my memory. So beyond strength, there's attributes, specific things about the very piece of information that I'm trying to remember. So let's just stick with this super, super simple example, and we're going to move beyond this in complexity. I meet Bob. And remember, one of the goals with this discussion is mindful intake. So when I'm told Bob, I say, Bob, that's a palindrome, not out loud. But something as simple as like, that name is a palindrome. That name has three letters. That name starts with B. My name starts with B. And that brings us to the third aspect of these memory strategies. First was strength. Second was attributes. Third is associations. So those are three categories of encoding strategies that we're going to talk about today. Let's start with strength. In school, we try to increase the strength of memory traces, usually not by paying attention, but simply by rehearsal, which, as I said earlier in this discussion, is kind of a mindless process and is usually only good for creating sort of fleeting working memories. So you're introduced to somebody named Bob, but then a conversation begins with Bob. You learn, you know, 9 or 10 things about Bob, a lot of, sensory intake, Bob's outfit, the way Bob speaks, the way Bob looks at you or looks around, his interest level in the conversation. There's, endless amounts as far as our brains are concerned anyway, endless amounts of sensory data. So our working memories are inundated with, you know, more than what they can hold, 7 pieces of information. And somewhere in that process, we've had to jettison the name Bob.
No, but wait, I thought we were supposed to pay attention to all these other things about Bob. His outfit, his body language, his demeanor, because of the whole gravity thing that I just mentioned. Yeah, sure, if we're doing mindful intake. Think about meeting somebody new for the first time in a loud, noisy, crowded situation. How mindful are you being about remembering that person's name, especially if you're being introduced to more than one person at once? This is a contrast between the way at least I was taught to remember things, or at least to work with things in the short-term memory through rehearsal and repetition, versus a mindful engagement in the surroundings with an intentionality for absorbing new information. Big difference.
So let's move beyond something that's as simple as trying to remember that some guy named Bob's name is Bob. We're trying to make useful new memories when we encounter new information. We do this by focusing attention on details that we should try to register. One of the most effective that I have found in learning is what we could call a mental snapshot. For a long time, I considered myself to be a very, very visual learner. So if I'm trying to capture important information about a new subject, one of the most helpful introductions is an infographic. So I search infographics on a certain subject to try to find the one that I find, you know, the most aesthetically pleasing, but also the most coherent. I scan it systematically, and then I put it aside. I usually save it in my Evernote, but I get it so it's not in front of my eyes anymore, and I question myself about it. So let's say I'm trying to understand the parts of the brain involved in memory. I'll find an infographic that provides that knowledge, and I'll look at it for, I don't know, maybe 20 seconds, and I'll try to rely on previously stored information that is now much more likely to be recalled because it's being jogged by this image that I'm looking at. Then I'll close it or just close my eyes, and I'll try to run through as much as I can remember. Then I'll open it again or open my eyes and repeat that process until I have captured a sufficient amount of detail. I find this to be an incredibly efficient and useful process in making new memories because of the deliberation that it requires. Now, I understand that looking at infographics about the human brain and then closing my eyes and quizzing myself does not make me a neurologist. This is an introduction, a way to get a firm footing, a way to capture something that can stay with me using methods and media through which I've realized I learn best. The old advice on the show used to be, go to Wikipedia. You want to learn a new topic? Ooh, from the Greek, topos? Meaning place? That's interesting, isn't it? Let's keep going. You want to learn a new topic? Well, you're going to need a map for that place. And back in the day, it was fine to just go and get that map from, you know, the first paragraph and the table of contents in a Wikipedia article. A great place to start. But for me, I've found that going through this process of mental snapshot, I have something that becomes solid. And as I go further into a subject, I have a clear picture in my mind to which I can reference back as needed. So looking at it, just to be super clear, looking at infographics and closing your eyes is not a learning system. It's an enhancement. It's a technique. Here's another one. And let's call this one a sensual inventory. Ooh, that sounds pretty hot. I touched on this just briefly in, I think, the first or second show in The Creative Pursuit back in March. And this is a mindfulness practice. And while I talked about it being good for creativity, I think it has some payoffs for memory as well. And here's why. Now, the first attention technique that we talked about, the mental snapshot, more for intellectual development. I would say this is more for personal development. You know, I go out every day. I try to make each day great. I try to have novel experiences. So sensual imagery has a lot to do with the richness of our personal lives, our relationships, our romances, our self-knowledge and subsequent self-improvement. Our lives are the sum of our memories. And it feels to me like, you know, I'm doing cool things every week. I'm spending time with, you know, people who are smart and interesting. And so much of that for so long just seemed like it faded away.
I think of an event like Porkfest, where I'll meet, you know, 150 people. I'll have interesting conversations. The whole week is such a whirlwind. And this is from, you know, the experience over the course of several years, that it's like, I think that was a really good time. But, you know, I feel like a lot of it is lost. So there's that lesson that we get from the movie I've referenced several times, Memento. Or there's another story about an amnesic named HP, who was not as competent as Leonard. He couldn't even remember that he had retrograde amnesia. But the meaning we make of our lives, it comes from our memories. So the sensual inventory is a mindfulness practice. And I'll give you an example of one I did recently. It was just Memorial Day, and I went to my friend Puke's house down in Keene, and his land is adjacent to a golf course. And a few of us, you know, during this barbecue, we said, let's walk over to the golf course. A little after 7 p.m., course was empty. The sun was setting. It was me, my friend Puke, my friend Nick, my friend Tom. And we walked, you know, I don't know, 50 paces through the woods, and we were on this empty golf course. And the quiet, the color, the smell, the feel, it was such a beautiful moment. And we didn't have any clubs or balls, but we kind of stood there on the tee. And I said, this is really nice. I said it out loud. I said it out loud in a dorky way. And then I just took, while those guys talk, I just took, I don't know, 20 seconds and went through an inventory of my senses, sight, sound, touch, and smell. It wasn't much to taste. And now I have that, a nice moment that lasted no more than 5 minutes. But it was just one of those moments that had a kind of richness to it that I wanted to capture. And if you were frustrated earlier in the show with the whole memory palace thing, I'm sorry. I know I'm really taxing your patience with this gay story. But it was meaningful to me. And it doesn't take an elaborate memory palace to capture something like that. The memory palace works because of the deliberation and the mindfulness that goes into it. And the same is true with this experience. And another attention technique that really, really complements the first two, and this could be for personal or intellectual development, is reflection, which is the process of, you know, after an experience, shortly after an experience, I would say usually the same day, reminiscing about the event that took place. Some people do this when, you know, they lie down in bed at night and close their eyes. They try to, you know, reconstruct mentally an experience that happened that day. Maybe try to find a significance in it. For me, the best strategy has been the 5-minute journal. So before I go to bed every night, three great things that happened today. And when I write these, I don't say, oh, I did a show. Oh, I did all my to-dos. Those are things that happen all the time. They're not special. So I try to, in this three great things that happened today, try to catalog novel experiences and reflect on them and expand them. So paying attention, remember this presence, a theme that we've talked about a lot on the show in the past, can have intellectual and personal payoffs. So those are three techniques for strengthening memory traces: mental snapshots, sensual imagery, and reflection. But if we shift more to the learning, like the information-based, I want to learn new things, making new memories, practices, let's talk about attribute techniques. So this is the second category, attributes. So again, at the risk of sounding repetitive, this is about gravity. We take in this singular new piece of information, but then we try to make that body bigger by adding detail, knowledge of attributes. So as that body drifts into the long-term memory, its bigger size makes it easier for us to recall later when needed. So we talked about attributes of Bob, but what do I mean attributes about specific pieces of information? Again, this is that idea of mindful intake. First, one of the most important attribute considerations is semantic. I find it's very, very easy to get lost in a cluster of new information when I'm trying to learn about a new topic or a specific new concept. So thinking in terms of a dictionary definition, almost word by word as necessary, never ever skipping over a word if there's a lack of clarity
about what it means. I have a real hard time with this. So doing a meaning analysis as I go through a sentence or a paragraph or even something visual like an infographic is really, really important. Another attribute, feelings. Paying attention to what I feel about what I'm learning. And coupled with that could be judgment. Would this be categorized as positive or negative, good or bad, pleasing or agitating? And some really helpful ways to capture attributes. One would be the process of description. And sometimes this might be like if I'm reading about the frontal lobe of the brain, I might say something to myself like, this is useful here because essentially describing, and this is a good check too, making sure I'm not wasting time, describing the usefulness of the information in the bigger picture. So this is that global style of learning as I encounter it. So I'm reading about the frontal lobe of the brain, let's say, in preparation for this show, and I'm getting really caught up in some of the minutiae. See, having that real-time editorial process of what is needed and what information can be passed by, doing that kind of pause and describe, like, oh, okay, this is important because this part of the brain is really, really crucial in emotional control. And these three aspects of registering memories, they kind of work interchangeably. So I have this attribute about what I'm reading, frontal lobe of the brain, critical for emotional control. And then I can shift to an association and say, yes, in my experience, I remember this boy who had these executive functioning issues, and it created this set of problems. In interactive processes, in this attribute phase, things like description and relating lead to other attribute strategies, like questioning and priority rating. So as I'm learning, let's just stick with the frontal lobe example, and I encounter a new piece of information. I'm cycling these questions like where, why, how, under what conditions, how much, how many, how often, to make sure I'm not just skimming the surface of something that I really, really want to capture. And related to that questioning is a priority rating. So as I go through tons and tons of information and I can find myself getting lost in the minutiae, I might say, how important is this specific piece of information in the bigger picture? So assigning a priority to it of importance, like is this primary, is this secondary, is this supporting, gives it another attribute that helps solidify it as a memory. And that helps me map it visually, which we know by now in this show is ultimately how I will be able to remember it. So those are attribute strategies. Anything we can register into our memory can be characterized by a set of attributes. So the more attributes we include when we make a new memory, the better. Each additional way of thinking or detail about what we're trying to record increases the strength of that recording long term. Think about one of these pieces of information as a fish with many mouths. And when you take your rod and you cast your line of recall or retrieval, you have all these different ways to catch that fish. But do not eat a fish that has more than one mouth. That means there's something wrong with the water where that fish lives. This is just a visualization. So then we move on to association manipulations. So when there's an increase of the number of associations between a new piece of information and other information securely stored in your memory, that trace becomes more powerful and more meaningful. The more associations you have, the easier it is to retain and retrieve a memory. And we learn a lot by association, even things that we really don't need to know or we didn't even really mean to learn. Song lyrics are a great example of this. Let's think of a song we all know. How about Hotel California? I used it in a show not even that long ago. If I told you to start singing Hotel California, or even just the first verse, just sing the first verse of Hotel California from the beginning, we all remember how it begins, on a dark desert highway. But if I said, start singing the first verse from the word doorway, ooh, that's kind of a different task, right? Because we associate line by line. If you remember the first line, especially in a song, songs usually rhyme, you can pull up the second line and then the third line and then the fourth line. But if I say start singing it from doorway, there's no association attached to that. It's a doorway. Where does that even occur in the verse? But then if I said there she stood in the doorway, you would say, oh, yeah, I heard the mission bell. Now, association strategies are really about real-time organization of new information. So I'm going to give a couple of techniques for this. Forging connections. When you need to remember two or more different things, this is often the case, making a conscious effort to determine if they can be connected in some way. And if usually if they're part of the same subject, the answer is yes. So focusing on what that connection is, making that connection explicit, and then being mindful about rehearsing not just the items, two or more, but also the association between them. Related to this is the connection of past and present events, trying to find a similarity between something that you're experiencing now or an event that you're learning about now and a past event, looking for those connections. A third association strategy, meaningful relations, a compare and contrast process between two or more items that you're trying to learn. Now, all of this mindful intake and deliberation leads to a final association practice, diagramming. Mapping, a visual representation of the relationships we're forming. Now, I know I said in this series we would make an effort to rely on the mind itself, but there are some tools that are too valuable to pass up. And one of the ones that I would recommend to you, because it's fairly easy to learn to use, even though I do not use it that regularly, I prefer to go through a mind mapping process with pen and paper or on a dry erase board. But the personal brain software has proven to be, for many, many people that I know, the best method of mindful and meaningful encoding available. And I wanted to tie things together today with a clip from School Sucks Podcast, episode 233, in which Paul Verge, Richard Grove, and I discuss the brain software and how it relates to learning and memory. So, you know, clarity, understanding and memory really come, I think, from this harmony between imagination or creativity and organization, which is connection and associations. So on the show tonight, we're going to talk about this software, the brain, that I think really serves both processes very well. And I'm new to this. Rich and Paul have a considerable amount of experience with this. Rich, you were actually the one who I think introduced this to everybody in this community, right?
I've tried various products that, the idea is you need a capture device.
Yeah.
Let's start there before we get into the actual software.
Like, sure.
Right now I got a pad of paper and I got a Scribo of something to write with. And so I can capture stuff on a piece of paper, but it's not necessarily in any given order. It's just kind of, you know, brainstorming how things come to me. And you can't just drag and drop things and rearrange them. So paper has its limitations.
Right.
So what you can use with technology is software that outlines things not in a linear fashion, but in a almost 3D fashion, where it would be nonlinear and it has connectivity where you can see how things connect and say, I might want to reorganize my outline based on the connectivity that I just observed through using a piece of software that can help you put some of this information in an organized manner that ignites your creativity. Because I think there's a process of collection through observation,
mm-hmm.
and then you have to organize it, which is kind of what we're talking about. But the end result of that is being able to be creative and to demonstrate intellectual self-defense. So I use it primarily to assess knowledge, to validate knowledge, to encapsulate some of the research that I've done. But you can also use it to plan a family vacation or to organize your desk at work or to improve, you know, your day at work by having everything in something that is structured, because when it's structured and you're the one making those links and putting that structure together, inherently you are creating synapses in your brain.
Yeah.
So that learning that goes on is almost imprinted and you're programming yourself. You're starting from scratch and building your own brain model, or you can add on to someone else's or however you want to do it. I mean, that's your choice. But the idea is that once you start to interact with, let me read a source and start to, you know, encapsulate that information in a meaningful way. Otherwise, you could just take notes all the time, but
sure.
It's how do you process those notes in a meaningful way and integrate the contents of that into your life?
Yeah. And back to the creativity piece, and then I'll turn it over to Paul and he can add some thoughts. You mentioned non-linear thinking. That really contributes to people's creativity. Now, the list making
is linear. And that's how I think we often get stuck in these comfortable thinking patterns and these rule ruts. So whether we're talking about mind mapping, which is something that's existed for a long time, I have to give credit to Tony Buzan, who copyrighted that term, which is basically creating these more free-flowing visual representations of nonlinear thinking. The brain seems to also provide that you can actually have a map. You can have a visual representation of nonlinear thinking. It's easy to make a visual representation of linear thinking because it's a list or an outline. So this is not only an organizational tool, but a very valuable creative tool as well.
I think it's also good for exercising your memory.
Yeah,
because
absolutely.
A lot of people have a short attention span, and the way you lengthen your attention span is by giving your brain meaningful content to chew on and process. And I think the other dead end of the outline, as I would know it, right, as we've all learned through public schooling, is that they don't teach you that the purpose of an outline is to have an entry point, a substance point, and then an egress, an exit point.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can't, you know, a lot of people can write into their outline, I got a great idea for a beginning, here's the middle, but they don't know how to get out. So if you think about those things before you try to structure what you're going to write on your SAT or any other given output, think about your input, your processing, and your output.
Right,
which is
right.
The same structure that you would be communicating on a piece of paper.
Absolutely. So Paul, anything to add to our introduction to the brain here?
Well, I would say that if we recognize the apparent truth that we're all as human beings kind of conditionable, that gives us the opportunity to not only prevent being conditioned through intellectual self-defense, but to self-condition through repetition of creating good habits, right? And so the act of having something like the brain software really gives you not only the ability to organize in a tangible way that you can share with others, but every time you're looking at your brain model, you're visually anchoring this idea structure. And there's a lot of times you can nest ideas within sort of like child ideas or sub ideas.
Yeah.
So it allows you to kind of, if you've ever heard of the term memory palaces, that's a structured, ordered way of thinking where you design basically a house of an overarching idea. And then each room is a sub idea associated with that thought. And it helps people memorize, you know, hundreds or thousands of facts associated with one thing. Well, this is essentially doing it for you in a way that you can externalize it and refer to it and constantly update it, right? Like Rich was saying, with paper, once you fill the piece of paper, it's full. Like, you got to either flip it over or get a new piece. With this, because of the technology, you're just constantly updating the model as new information becomes available or new connections become relevant.
So we're going to wrap up there for today. We've discussed three types of strategies for mindful intake, what is also referred to as elaborative encoding. They were the strengthening of new memories by the simple processes of intention and attention. Second was inventorying attributes of the new information. And third, an organizational practice, the forming of associations. Now, there's some more information that I want to include on this topic, but it's really not anything original. It would just basically be me reading articles or pages out of a book. So if you want some supplemental strategies, I'm going to put a free audio on schoolsucksproject.com where I'm going to go over what Douglas Herman in his book Super Memory called mind manipulations. We'll talk about elaboration strategies, reduction strategies, and transformation strategies. And I'll also include some information on developing visualization skills. And in the notes, I'll also include a link to Joshua Foer's TED Talk. He was the journalist that I mentioned who won the memory competition. Feats of memory, anyone can do. It covers a lot of similar ground. A lot of it will be review after listening to the show, but it's 20 minutes and it's worth a watch. So remember, the parts of your brain that participate in the memory process are inclined and evolved for visual, spatial, and navigational tasks. And I hope that's something that you'll keep in mind in future learning and the mindful making of new memories. Thanks for listening, everybody. And by the way, I know I said that these themes were going to be defined by months of the year. I know this one is running a little long. It was a pretty hectic month with the move and everything, and there's still some residual effects of that, you know, going out and looking for new appliances, not at the dump, you know, at Home Depot and stuff. Lots of shopping, lots of exploring. But I'm hoping in the next few weeks, the content becomes a little more stable and predictable. And for everybody who supports the show with your money or your time or your sharing of ideas or your promotion, thank you so much. And thanks for your patience over the course of the last month. I'll try to have this memory series wrapped up by, let's say, the 10th of June.
And then we'll be on to our next theme. I hope you're having a great month. Take care.
I know where you went, but I don't know.